fire restrictions went into effect today around Arizona. That's an annual event, but what's unusual is how early it's happening. It's shaping up to be a long fire season.
Let's be clear, the Southwest is built to burn. There's always something to burn here. If we have a wet winter, the desert burns because lots of stuff has grown up. If we have a dry winter, the mountains burn.
I'm Mark Brody. Today on the show, fighting and preventing wildfires. Also, Arizona's U.S. senators speak out about problems with the Phoenix VA, revitalizing a Phoenix neighborhood by sprucing up its mall. And we go retro to celebrate Record Store Day.
For me, the excitement of going to a record store is walking in and having some record playing that you've never heard and that you have no idea what it is.
Plus, what is Southwestern food and what's new at the West Valley Zoo? That and more on the show after a check of this hour's news. Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ. I'm Mark Brody. With a quick check of Valley traffic, US 60 westbound, there's an accident blocking the left lanes. I-17 northbound, an accident on the exit ramp at Thomas. What you see outside is probably what we're going to get for the next couple of days or so. Cloudy skies today. Very slight chance for some rain, possibly some thunderstorms later today with a high of 85 degrees. Right now, it's cloudy and 80 degrees at KJZZ. Officials are reporting progress in fighting a wildfire burning near Sierra Vista in southeastern Arizona. Fire managers say the brown fire in the Huachuca Mountains is now 25% contained. That's after low fire behavior yesterday allowed firefighters to strengthen containment lines as helicopters dropped water on the fire. More than 400 people are assigned to the fire, including 10 ground crews. Helicopters and air tankers are also available. Fire managers say no structures are currently threatened, but residents of canyon areas have been told to be ready to evacuate. The fire is estimated at 240 acres. It's burning in brush and timber in steep and rugged terrain, mostly on Fort Huachuca, an Army base, and in the Coronado National Forest. The fire started on Sunday. Thousands of Mexican truckers are threatening to blockade Arizona border crossings. They say they have to wait in long lines and undergo too many inspections at U.S. ports of entry. Arizona Department of Transportation spokesman Tim Tate says the agency wants the federal government to address the truckers' complaints.
What we are encouraging is that the truckers and the Federal Motor Carrier Safety Administration sit down and talk about these concerns and really open up an active discussion to resolve some of these concerns and try to find some resolution that doesn't involve a blockade of the border.
Tate says this is the peak of Mexico's harvest season and about 2,000 produce trucks cross into Arizona each day. The truckers announced they're going to stage the border protest last month, but there hasn't been a blockade yet. Arizona Senators John McCain and Jeff Flake today spoke out about problems with the Phoenix VA in the same place veterans rallied earlier this week, demanding politicians take action. KJZZ's Carrie Young was at this morning's press conference as well as Wednesday's rally and joins me now. Hi, Carrie.
Hi.
So what's the problem? What's going on with the Phoenix VA?
What really set tempers flaring earlier this week and led to the rally yesterday was Representative Jeff Miller from Florida has revealed that a House Committee on Veterans Affairs has concluded that as many as 40 Arizona veterans may have died as a result of a delay in care. And so people came out on Wednesday to rally to get congressional changes made. And then Senators Flake and McCain came out to meet with VA administration today and then also to address the press and a crowd of veterans to assure them that action was going to be taken.
And what did the senators have to say?
The senators were, they were clearly very concerned about the allegations that are being made, and they said what seemed to be an increase in complaints coming from Arizona veterans, or Phoenix veterans more specifically, about what's happening at the VA.
Let's hear from Senator John McCain.
There is a serious problem in the VA. Absolutely there is. And Congress has oversight responsibilities, and we will continue to act as effectively as we can. Like any other bureaucracy, it needs congressional oversight and it needs funding.
Arizona Senator John McCain speaking earlier today about the Phoenix VA. Carrie, did veterans groups seem satisfied with this response?
They seemed satisfied with the level of attention that the senators were bringing to this issue. And yes, I would say they were satisfied with the response, although Dan Caldwell with Concerned Veterans for America said that, you know, it's more than just a funding issue, though.
The VA has received an incredible amount of resources since the beginning of the war on terror. So I'm glad that the VA is actually now admitting that, according to the senators recognize that along with most of the congressional delegation. So we're glad that we've recognized, okay, this isn't a funding issue, this is an internal cultural issue at VA that needs to be resolved.
So, Carrie, what's next?
What happens next is an investigation. There's been a protective order issued on the records within the Phoenix VA to make sure that there are no records disposed of. There's also allegations of duplicate records within the VA, so they want to make sure everything stays in place for that investigation, and they'll, you know, pass judgment after those results from that come out.
KJZZ's Carrie Young. Carrie, thanks.
Thank you.
When Jackie Robinson took the field for the Brooklyn Dodgers on opening day, April 15, 1947, he forever changed the face of Major League Baseball, shattering the so-called color barrier, a 50-year-old tradition of segregation.
On the anniversary of Jackie Robinson's first game this week, Major League Baseball honored his legacy. But 67 years on, fewer than 8.5% of players on opening day rosters were African American. MLB has undertaken a few efforts to change that. Diamondbacks president and CEO Derek Hall is part of one of them, MLB's on-field diversity task force.
Our diversity in baseball, and we're looking at the players on the field, it's an all-time high. Yet we look at one area in particular, and it's African Americans, and our participation level is way down. So the commissioner assembled this group, and it was a very diverse group, so that we can examine and address the various factors affecting the talent pipeline of African Americans to baseball. And we're looking at data. We're interviewing players who either chose to go into baseball or chose not to, as to why. We're looking at everything as far as cost involved, availability of fields, equipment, coaching, and we've come up with some very surprising answers.
Like what?
Well, you know, we really see coaching as the biggest issue. In talking to people, you know, there's no issue with playing baseball because nearly every kid will play baseball or softball at the little league level. And where we see the drop-off is around 12 years of age. And in most of the interviews that we did and focus groups that we did, it was because of coaching that did not influence them in a very positive way. The other thing, which you would obviously imagine, is cost. You know, it's very costly to play baseball when it comes to equipment. So we want to make that equipment more readily available. We want to have the space and the fields available for them. Major League Baseball, for about the last 10 to 15 years, has been creating these urban youth leagues, and we want to expand on the urban baseball initiatives, which, you know, RBI, Reviving Baseball in the Inner Cities, has been a big one. The MLB Urban Youth Academies now, and bringing various grassroots programs around the country. These academies have been a big hit. It's getting kids off the streets. It's teaching them how to play baseball. And those that aren't talented on the field can learn other skills. So we teach them how to be physical trainers. We teach them how to be grounds crew, umpires, et cetera. And it's also schooling as well.
You mentioned the RBI program, and that's been around for quite a while, about 25 years. And I'm curious if you think that there's something that that program could be doing differently that, I mean, clearly what it's doing now doesn't seem to be working.
Well, we just need to grow. We need to expand on it, and we need to participate more with RBI to make sure that they have the funding necessary to expand, to make sure that we're playing in all the right cities, that it's not just, you know, the Sun Belt, that we're also getting into those minor league cities where there is so much interest in baseball. If we could get RBI into the more cold weather cities to make sure that they're playing in the summer months. There's more that we can do as resources behind RBI.
The Diamondbacks are one of three teams in the major leagues that don't have any African-American players. And I'm curious if it's something that you actively look at when you're scouting, when you are looking at who is in your minor league system, who's on your major league roster, things like that?
Well, it's definitely an issue, and it's a problem in my eyes. And, you know, it's more glaring of the overall problem with Major League Baseball and the decline in the numbers, where, you know, we're really at an all-time high right now, or an all-time low, I should say, in the number participating. So we have to get more of the talented players in. Yeah, we all need to do a better job in scouting African-American players, and I think these urban academies are a good way for us to do that, Mark. I think what we'll do is we'll send scouts directly to the academies, and hopefully we'll sign players through there. But it is, you know, it's becoming a bit of an epidemic.
Is there a target percentage of African Americans that this task force or you personally would like to see in the majors?
No, we haven't put a number on it, but, you know, that's a great question. And I would say if we could get back to that level, that would be the goal, to get near that 20% again, where we were at such a healthy level in 1986. I would love to see us start to trend in that direction. We definitely want to see an upward tick. We haven't put a targeted goal on a percentage, but I would like to see us get back to that recovery point where we were so high in 1986.
Derek Hall, president and CEO of the Diamondbacks, also a member of MLB's on-field diversity task force. Derek, thanks.
Thank you, Mark.
Fire restrictions went into effect today on several of Arizona's national forests, as well as on state-owned and managed lands. The restrictions aim to prevent human-caused wildfires and are generally going into effect earlier than in past years. ASU fire historian Steve Pine says there are implications of an earlier fire season, but they're not all bad.
There are two issues to that. One is that fire seasons in general in the West seem to be lengthening, and the other is this particular year, which is a drought year. In California and the Southwest generally. So you've got a compounding set of conditions, which to most thinking aggravates the situation. It means that you have to prepare earlier. You have to have crews and equipment prepositioned earlier than you would normally. All of that means some more effort, more money, more investment. But there are always two sides to things, and having longer seasons also means that you're lengthening the opportunities to do controlled burning, and that's an opportunity we should try to seize. Let's be clear, the Southwest is built to burn. There's always something to burn here. If we have a wet winter, the desert burns because lots of stuff has grown up. If we have a dry winter, the mountains burn. So every year there's something, and at some point you just have to think about this systemically. We know how to handle most of this. We just need to decide it's worth our effort.
When you talk about resources, how much of what Arizona is able to do comes down to what happens in other states? And we've heard so much about how California is so dry and ripe for fires and has had some fires. How much of an impact does what happens in California and Colorado and New Mexico have on what happens here in Arizona resource-wise?
Yeah, that's a very pertinent question. And I mean, it goes to the heart of fire as an emergency response, which is to say that most agencies will plan for an average worst year. But it's not the average worst or the average that matters. It's the extreme events where everything is overloaded. And there's no way to build up, or we're not willing to pay the huge costs to build up for those extreme events.
Is there a scenario under which you can imagine that the state and federal government would have enough resources, money, tankers, people to adequately fight the worst-case scenario fires?
Well, I think so. But, I mean, in the extreme, you would turn the state into the fire equivalent of a police state. I mean, you would have to have so much out there and invest so much of your resources in that you're not going to be able to do a whole lot else. So that really puts the burden on preparation.
Do you think that what's going on this year with restrictions going into effect earlier and the fire season starting sooner, is this a new normal or is this a cyclical thing and it'll go back to the way it was in a number of years?
Well, it's both. I mean, the evidence suggests that, in fact, the climate is changing. It's changing in ways that are lengthening fire season. And on average, that is not likely to return to what it was on average before. But we're still going to have lots of variation year by year. But all the indications are that conditions will worsen, climatic conditions. And that leaves us with the other options for coping with fire, which is to say being able to fight fires. And we do need the capacity to suppress fires. But we also need to be able to harden our houses and communities. We know how to do that, to put the landscape into a form that we get fires that we can live with, not fires that will simply overrun our capabilities. There's no single response here. What you need to do is everything.
Steve Pine is a fire historian at ASU. Still to come, the city of Phoenix has unveiled a plan to save Metro Center. People who live nearby say the mall's financial instability is adding to the problems in their community.
I'm noticing we have more vagrants. I'm noticing, oh, this house is empty and someone's broken in there, or they graffitied the alley. You know, so we started seeing all the things that kind of made us feel like the neighborhood was run down.
That story and more, it's the show. In Valley traffic, one problem spot to tell you about, it is on US 60 westbound, the HOV lane, blocked by an accident at Priest. The clouds will stick around for the rest of the day. Very slight chance for some rain and a high of 85. Mostly cloudy tonight. Still a slight chance of rain. Overnight lows in the lower 60s. This is the show on KJZZ. More of our community mixed with national stories and international news. It's 219.
KJZZ is supported by Phoenix Theater presenting Avenue Q through May 18th. An R-rated comedy with a surprisingly poignant message about making it on your own and finding your purpose. Avenue Q tickets at phoenixtheater.com.
This is KJZZ. I'm John Huckenberry.
And I'm Mark Brody.
There is a competition going on in America's cities, and it's not pretty. Workers competing for housing in Seattle and San Francisco, New York and Boston and other cities. An influx of highly paid workers in growing industries raises housing prices and marginalizes middle and working class workers, forcing them farther from the city or in some cases right onto the streets. The parallel universe of homelessness in urban America is there if you know where to look for it. In New York, most of the homeless are in homeless shelters of some kind. On the West Coast, unsheltered homeless people living on the streets is the norm. In San Francisco, more than 61% of the homeless population is unsheltered. They walk like shadows amongst the commuters from San Francisco's most desirable neighborhoods, working in places like the tech bubble of Silicon Valley. Tech entrepreneur Kevin Adler hopes to burst that bubble and make homelessness more visible. His Homeless GoPro project gives GoPro cameras to homeless volunteers to document their experiences, opening a window on the web to see the reality of homelessness with the same HD resolution people use to take video of their ski vacations and snowboarding stunts. Kevin Adler and his homeless collaborator cameraman Adam Reichart spoke with us about their plan that won't give anyone a home, but it might give the community something almost as valuable.
One of the reasons I got involved in this is that I've noticed in the last few years, I've been homeless on now for almost 6 years, and selling the street sheet here in San Francisco, I found that it's almost like doing a social experiment where you get to learn a lot about people's behavior. And I've noticed over, especially the last 2 or 3 years, that people are really starting to lose their empathy and compassion towards humanity, not just in homelessness in general, but in homelessness is a big part of it.
You guys, the Bay Area Reporters did a story on me last week. I'm having all my teeth surgically extracted next Wednesday, and I'm trying to get up enough for a month's rent. Have a good day, guys. The Bay Area Reporters did a story on me last week. I'm getting all my... having all my teeth surgically extracted next week. You have a good day, honey.
To Kevin Adler, how do you think empathy plays into this, and how do GoPro cameras on the street, and again, we're just at the beginning of this experiment, how do GoPro cameras and images that they provide engage this sense of empathy?
Yeah, I think empathy is a very powerful force. You know, it's a way to have a more of an established shared concept of human dignity, which I think is important for all the other types of service organizations that do provide the essential homes and shelters and food and other indispensable needs of homeless individuals. You know, this is a piece of technology that a lot of people, young professionals, have, and it's very accessible to us. We'll go on a weekend and capture some footage from snowboarding or surfing. My life's not that exciting, but, you know, conceivably. And then share it with our friends. And I think homeless individuals have, you know, their own lives, and we don't yet have a great snapshot of what their daily experiences and interactions are. So the idea would be to use a little bit of technology to extend that and empower their voices and to share their stories.
How do you respond to the reaction that, oh, great, here's a California tech guy with a technology solution for homelessness? That's really inspiring, but it's not going to actually solve the problem. How do you respond to that?
Well, I think, you know, I'd start first, you know, with the origins of the project. So my uncle Mark was homeless for 30 years. And he lived on and off the streets. He had schizophrenia, and he died about 10 years ago. He was found by himself in a halfway house. So I think empathy is a pretty good thing to build everywhere. And certainly in kind of the divisive environment in which we're in with debate around tech workers and affordable housing, we're not wanting to be on either side of the debate. We are all people. We're all in this together. We're one city. And this is a way to help better connect the city through a little bit of empathy and a little bit of technology.
You know, I'm glad you brought up the competition for low-income housing and the tech workers who do compete for those properties and, by some accounts, drive up the price. Adam Reichardt, do you see tech workers as, competing for homes, driving up rents, creating some of the problems that might be, the cause of your homelessness on some level?
I wouldn't say the cause of my homelessness, but the cause of me getting housed again, yes. Because it's like, I just had some medical procedures done this week, and I had to get a place, so I went and rented a hotel for a week. And it cost me $350 for a week in a room with no toilet, no sink, no shower. And the same room, like 3 to 5 years ago, would have been $100, $150.
Now, those are the kinds of images that if you recorded them on the GoPro might make a pretty powerful economic point about the competition among workers in the Bay Area. Is there a concern, Kevin, that through this GoPro technology that people will be able to observe the lives of homeless people safely through a screen on their smartphone or their computer when maybe the more powerful empathy would be to see them, in 3D, high resolution, in the places and on the streets where they actually live, encountering them in the course of a day?
I'd kind of refer to something Adam told me after the first San Francisco Chronicle article ran, which is he said, the money has increased a little, but the humanity has increased a lot. It's lifting my spirits and making me wanting to better myself. And he said, he estimated, and Adam, correct me if I'm wrong, but that 75 to 100 people over the last few days have recognized him, expressed appreciation for what he's doing, and said, Adam, I've seen you here for years, but I haven't had a better sense of who you are and your backstory.
Adam, what was it like to experience that?
It's been a really wild week. The first day that me and Kevin talked, and I thought about this afterwards, I thought in my own head, if I could just touch one person's life out of all this, it'll make me satisfied that I did something with this project. And I just wanted to share with your audience that, some people have sent me some really inspiring affirmations and that I've inspired them. And that a couple of the messages have even said that they were going to, get involved. One guy said he was going to volunteer at a homeless place in Germany. And another guy said that he was going to volunteer locally here. And you know what? That makes this whole project, makes me feel good in my heart about this whole project that, I feel like to a point we've already accomplished a little bit of something.
Well, thanks, guys.
Thanks, John. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, really appreciate you having us on the show, John.
Kevin Adler is a co-founder of the Homeless GoPro Project. Adam Reichardt is a homeless man and a participant in that project.
That's The Takeaways. John Hockenberry. It's the show on KJZZ, and these are the sounds of the city.
Attention, go.
It's fresh. We're going to squeeze together.
My name's Audrey Luzader, and I'm out rowing crew.
All right, we're picking up the catches here.
We're getting ready for our collegiate championships in Sacramento.
When your legs are at full compression, you want that leg in the water.
It's really hard to wake up at 5 a.m., but when you have such a good team and people who you know are depending on you, that's what gets you here.
That's it, good.
It's probably one of the most team-oriented sports you're going to get. Nothing works if even just one person is out of it or one person doesn't show. Everything is based on your team.
That's Audrey Luzader rowing with the ASU crew team. If you've got ideas or hear things that make Phoenix unique, send us a note. The show at KJZZ.org. Still to come, when you think of Southwestern food, what do you think of?
We're sort of stuck in there with tacos and nachos. Well, there's nothing wrong with tacos and nachos. I think Southwest still has a big learning curve.
We'll try to figure it out. That's ahead. It's the show. In Valley traffic, accident US 60 westbound has the HOV lane blocked at Priest. Elsewhere, I-10 eastbound, an accident blocking the shoulder at 24th Street, also one at 32nd Street. Cloudy skies for the rest of the day across the valley. Very slight chance we could see some rain. Look for a high of 85 degrees. Cloudy tonight, overnight lows in the lower 60s. It's 80 degrees at KJZZ at 229.
KJZZ is supported by AJ's Fine Foods, celebrating a blush of spring with a selection of rosé wines to enjoy with your favorite cuisine. A list of 11 Valley locations can be found at ajsfinefoods.com.
The city of Phoenix is trying to save one of the valley's aging shopping malls. It's approved a plan to revitalize Metro Center and the surrounding neighborhoods in Northwest Phoenix. KJZZ's Steve Shadley reports on the mall's future.
Anyone who's lived in the valley for a long time probably remembers the excitement when Metro Center opened more than 40 years ago. At the time, it was promoted as the largest shopping mall in the country. Robin Mofford grew up near the mall during the 1970s.
Actually, at the time that Metro Center was originally developed, I was 17. And I recall the empty fields, and it was to become the prime area. And you could meet all your shopping needs all in one place.
During its first three decades, Metro Center was pretty successful. It was the cool place to go see a movie or do some ice skating. It has nearly 1.5 million square feet of retail space. But when the recession hit a few years ago, store after store closed. Now about a third of the mall is vacant. Music plays from a loudspeaker at Metro Center's Castles and Coasters miniature golf course, but there's nobody around to hear it. Granted, it's 11 a.m., but the parking lot surrounding the mall is almost empty.
I do see that this area needs new development. It needs businesses to come in.
Sherry Dudak has lived near Metro Center for more than 20 years, and she's with a neighborhood block watch group. She says the mall's financial challenges are creating problems in the community.
Northern and 27th Avenue is part of my neighborhood, and it used to be a safe area. We have a lot of prostitutes. We have a lot of vagrants.
Dudak hopes curbing crime will help Metro Center bounce back, but she's concerned about the businesses that could open there.
I don't want to see them put in 15 sports bars or, you know, have off-track betting. Everything has to be balanced out.
Last month, Phoenix City Council approved a redevelopment plan for the Metro Center area. It includes nearby neighborhoods that stretch to North Mountain. Councilwoman Thelda Williams is leading the city's effort to bring new life to the district.
This is a prime example of how you can do a large infill project in Phoenix, and we've not had that opportunity before. I say this is the place to do it.
Williams is trying to connect Metro Center with the Valley's light rail system, but that would require a bridge across Interstate 17 and the Arizona Canal.
We have a light rail. You can park at Metro Center, hop on that light rail, and takes it right off of I-17.
The city of Phoenix is dealing with a massive budget shortfall, but Williams says Metro Center redevelopment will move forward. That's where Lewis Snow comes in. He created a North Phoenix business group that's looking for ways to pay for improvements that will benefit the mall and small independent businesses.
The funding is going to be limited through the city of Phoenix, so we're going to have to go outside, and that's going to have to be through the grant process because the community itself doesn't have any money, I can tell you that. You know, between the residential and the businesses, I mean, everybody's struggling right now.
More than half of the residents in the area make less than $50,000 a year, according to the U.S. Census. The owners of Metro Center are also looking for investors to help with redevelopment expenses. Warren Fink is with the Carlyle Development Group in New York City that purchased Metro Center while it was in bankruptcy 2 years ago. He wants Phoenix to approve new zoning rules for the mall.
Allowing us to bring uses such as office, medical office, healthcare facilities. We would love to see some sort of multifamily or senior housing brought to that site. We're talking to a college about taking one of the vacant department stores.
Fink says his group also wants to put a high-rise building at the mall, but some neighbors are concerned that a 15-story structure would be an eyesore and it might create more traffic. Some residents are worried the city may raise taxes to help pay for the improvements, but others say they don't mind a small tax hike if that means their home values would increase. Steve Shadley, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
So maybe this has happened to you. It's definitely happened to me. Friends or family come to town and tell you they want to go out to eat Southwestern food. And you're thinking, well, like, what exactly does that mean? My colleague Steve Goldstein spoke with Karen Zoldan, the Tucson food and drink contributor for Arizona Foothills Magazine Online, about that very issue.
How strictly can we define what Southwest cuisine is? Do you have things in mind when you think of that, when you go around to restaurants in Tucson, other places in Arizona?
I do. I think of chilies, and I think of tequila, something that's a little smoky in a good way. I think of a lot of spice. I don't think of the traditional meat and potatoes, although meat and potatoes could be on the menu, but it would have maybe some kind of chipotle sauce twist. But I think of more deserty foods that are part of the environment.
Is that a perception or a definition that you think is becoming more widespread? Do people understand more now what Southwest cuisine is? Is it evolving?
I don't think it's evolving that fast. I think people still think of Southwest. We're sort of stuck in there with tacos and nachos. Well, there's nothing wrong with tacos and nachos. I think Southwest still has a big learning curve.
Do you think it's possible that Southwest cuisine will start to become more well-known, not just regionally, but nationally? Is there a reason to think that that could happen, especially as we talk about more people coming here as visitors, if those who own restaurants or chefs were more willing to try and be a little bit more Southwestern? Is there a possibility that could spread across the country? Hey, I tried this amazing thing in Tucson or this amazing thing in Phoenix.
I think it's possible. I think this region is so rich with our wine region in northern Arizona and in southeast Arizona, and we have a lot of microbreweries. I think when the alcohol people and the food people marry each other, pair with each other, they could lead the way for a big Southwest movement.
Do you have a favorite when you think about Southwest cuisine? I know we talked some about the flavors, but is there some dish that you have had that you think this is the type of dish that people who want to try Southwest cuisine should have?
I love anything that's chipotle, has a chipotle sauce, whether it's a pulled pork with chipotle or a corn pancake, just something spicy. I have a very jaded palate. So something with a distinct chili spice, maybe a poblano, grilled poblano chili stuffed with pulled pork and topped with some kind of cheese and black beans. To me, that's very Southwest. There's a lot of room for culinary tourism as a way to grow a desire for Southwest food, to inform from walking through the vineyards of some of the local wineries in southeast Arizona and probably northern Arizona, as well as Native Seed Search, which is in southern Arizona, and the local farmer, how they are using less energy or less harvesting water to irrigate their fields. I think that's all really important, and I think that's a way to grow the movement of Southwest food.
That was Karen Zoldan, the Tucson food and drink contributor for Arizona Foothills Magazine Online, speaking with Steve. Wildlife World Zoo and Aquarium is expanding to include a safari park. The West Valley Zoo just added a new area that people can walk through or see by train. ASU reporter Alexa Armstrong looks at how the addition is allowing guests to get closer to the animals.
A couple of colorful macaws greet visitors as they walk into the park. Kids splash their way through puddles from a recent storm. When the park opened 30 years ago, owner Mickey Olson wanted to be different.
We didn't want to duplicate what these institutions were already doing very well. So we decided to specialize in exotic animals.
The zoo has more than 600 different species, including a white lion, hyenas, wallabies, and lots of fish.
People like the closeness, and at this zoo we've tried to get people as close as they possibly can.
And he isn't kidding about getting close. The park features a petting zoo and the chance to walk through exhibits. One of the most popular is the giraffe feeding.
His tongue is all slimy.
The park also has 6 different rides, including a sky ride, Australian boat ride, and a safari tram.
That tram was pretty amazing. It was like the movie Jurassic Park.
In the new safari park, you walk through a big wooden archway and either climb on the tram or start heading down the path. Walls of palm trees, exotic plants, and wild animals from all over the world surround you. And the only thing that separates you from the animals is a chain link fence.
The aquarium took us to another level, and obviously the safari park is just icing on that cake.
The park is currently sitting on 80 acres of land, but it's not the size of the park that makes it successful.
You can have a very fine institution and very fine collection of very small numbers of animals, from an acre up to hundreds of acres.
Alan Saronin is on the board of directors at the Zoological Association of America and says Safari Park is one of more than 24 parks in his association that's expanding. Saronin says that members of his association have come from around the country to check out the park.
And then this new safari ride area, which is, you know, pretty exciting that people can get on a little ride area and go see the animals as they would potentially out in the, you know, a safari.
The zoo plans to expand even more in the next 2 to 3 years by building 4 more rides and adding more exhibits. For KJZZ, I'm Alexa Armstrong.
Alexa's story is part of a collaboration between the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University and KJZZ. A group of elected officials from Arizona last week met with some of their counterparts in Sonora, Mexico, and agreed to create what they're calling the Arizona-Sonora Binational Megaregion. This follows the announcement that Phoenix will open a trade office in Mexico City later this year and several other cross-border trade agreements and other deals. Michael Levant is the mayor of Youngtown and the incoming chair of the Maricopa Association of Governments Regional Council, which helped organize the trip.
We're actually looking at bootstrapping an economic binational mega region that straddles the border. And we went down last Thursday and Friday, and we actually signed our letter of intent, and we're looking at building trade on both sides of the border.
Is this mostly a trade kind of thing?
It is. We're looking. Well, I mean, I should say a trade is one dimension, a large dimension of what we're trying to accomplish. But we're really looking at trying to improve and add to the economy in both Sonora, Mexico, and Arizona.
How is this going to be different in your mind from organizations like the Arizona-Mexico Commission and the trade office that the state and Phoenix and some others have been trying to open in Mexico?
Well, you know, as far as the office in Mexico City, MAG is actually part of that. MAG is actually one of the partners. We at MAG, we've provided some financial resources to help make that happen. It's all part of a concerted and coordinated effort to improve relations with Mexico and in particular with the state of Sonora.
Is there any danger of sort of duplicating efforts with what this effort is trying to do and some of the others?
You know, there's always that danger, but I think there's enough coordination and everyone that is involved is being, you know, pretty transparent about what they're doing. I think there's enough coordination that rather than duplicate efforts, I think we're going to be enhancing each other's efforts.
Do you think that different countries have to be on friendly terms to be trading partners? I mean, Arizona and Mexico are pretty big trading partners as it is, and the relationship has kind of ebbed and flowed over the years. But, I mean, do you think the countries have to be on sort of friendly terms to enhance that?
I think it certainly helps, and that's part of what I want to emphasize. We were down there. Yes, we're looking for ways to build trade and build the economy, but we're also looking for ways to build trust with our counterparts on the Mexican side of the border. And I think it does help if you have a positive relationship with your border country. I think it enhances trade. I tell people all the time, I'd love to get to the point where we have the same problems at the Mexican border that we have at the Canadian border, namely none.
What do you think is the best case scenario to come out of this agreement? What do you think will be like the best tangible result that Arizonans and Valley residents will be able to see coming out of this?
To me, it's certainly the first step is going to be figuring out ways to enhance the trade between Arizona and Mexico, figuring out ways to improve the border situation between Mexico and Arizona, so we can really look at I think that's kind of low hanging fruit. We can do that and we can quickly begin to enhance our trade.
Youngtown Mayor Michael LaVault is the incoming chair of the MAG Regional Council. Good afternoon. You're listening to the show on KJZZ. In Valley traffic, U.S. 60 westbound now open at Priest. Arizona Senators John McCain and Jeff Flake met today with administrators of the Phoenix VA after allegations surfaced that around 40 veterans may have died as a result of a lack of care. The senators said there's a clear problem in the Phoenix VA and that Congress has the responsibility to use its oversight authority to help fix it. United Food Banks has named an interim president and CEO. Ginny Hildebrand will be taking over. She most recently served in the same position with the Association of Arizona Food Banks. We all know the library is for borrowing books, but let's be honest, sometimes you just flat out forget that due date and the library assesses you a fine. But for the next week, you can pay for that misplaced copy of The Great Gatsby with green beans and cans of tuna. Phoenix Public Libraries are teaming up with St. Mary's Food Bank and Desert Mission Food Bank for the annual Food for Fines event. If you have an unpaid library fine, you can pay it at any of the city's 17 locations with a canned or non-perishable food item. Each donated item knocks 50 cents off your library fine. St. Mary's spokesman Jerry Brown says food banks use this program to stock up for the summer.
We're just getting to the end of the school year. So many of these kids who get the free breakfast and free lunch through the school systems are now going to be home for the summer.
Brown says they're especially behind on canned fruits and veggies this year. The program has been going on for more than a decade. Phoenix Public Library's Rita Marco says the branch has collected almost 61,000 pounds of food last year for both food banks. That's an increase from previous years. You can pay up to $75 worth of fines in currencies of canned cherries to creamed corn, but only until April 27th. Been jonesing to bust out the old turntable? Tomorrow's the perfect day to do it. That's because it's Record Store Day, a sort of music lover's holiday that celebrates independent record stores and features tons of special vinyl releases, new and old. Jason Woodbury is with local record store chain Zia Records, which is taking part in the festivities.
It's just kind of a day in April where, you know, labels put out really cool exclusive vinyl pieces and basically all the record stores in town throw a big party.
So you brought some music for us.
I did. I brought a couple things that we're going to be putting out on Record Store Day, including a single that we at Zia Records worked with Arizona music historian John Dixon to create.
Johnny D,
yeah.
This is actually a record. Like, I'm pulling it out of the sleeve here, and it's kind of orangey and looks like something my grandparents might have played.
Yeah. Well, it's probably something your grandparents would have listened to, but it turns out that it's just as exciting sounding in 2014. This is two songs, Waylon Jennings and Sanford Clark, and they both recorded these in a studio here in Phoenix called Audio Recorders in the 60s. So we're all fans of this music, and we decided to work with John to create a series of records that celebrate the history and heritage of Audio Recorder Studio. So this is the first one in that series, and we're releasing it all over the country on Record Store Day.
Well, so let's listen to it. This is Sanford Clark, It's Nothing to Me.
Take your drink to the end of the bar, buddy, let her stay there, now don't
be a fool. I'd as soon have a hot seat in Sing Sing prison than to sit down by her on that stool.
So what are those unique things that happen in record stores that maybe don't happen when you download something from iTunes?
For me, it's just really like a social thing. Phoenix has a really thriving record store community, and for me, so much of the fun of listening to music is going into these stores and talking with people, hearing things that you wouldn't normally hear. Like iTunes and stuff like that, it's great. You know, you want to hear a Dr. Dre song or whatever, and you go Dr. Dre song, and then you buy that one song. But for me, the excitement of going to a record store is walking in and having some record playing that you've never heard and that you have no idea what it is, asking the person behind the counter, hey, what is this, and getting into a discussion and having this whole social element that, as much as I think streaming and downloading is cool, I mean, it's hard to kind of organically have that same feeling.
So I'm also drawn to this neon green album that you have with the Ghostbusters logo on it. And I guess this is a big year for Ghostbusters fans.
Yeah, this is the 30th anniversary of the film.
Making a lot of us feel very old.
Yeah, definitely. Ray Parker Jr.'s classic Ghostbusters. And this year, Record Store Day stores are going to have a glow-in-the-dark single with Ray Parker Jr. doing the Ghostbusters theme.
Something strange in your neighborhood. Who you gonna call? Ghostbusters! If there's something weird and it don't look good, who you gonna call? Ghostbusters!
I'm suddenly filled with nostalgia and I don't know why.
Yeah. Man, it's that beat, man. You got that Ghostbusters.
Does anything say 80s better than that opening sequence?
No, I don't think so. I think that this is it's a quintessential 80s moment, you know,
yeah.
Ghostbusters. That's one thing that everybody, it's like that thing that unites so many people of a certain age. You hear that Ghostbusters theme and it's like immediately everybody's taken back to their childhood.
So the last thing you brought is not, in fact, a record, but a CD, very, very 20th century, late 20th century here.
Yeah.
And this has your store's logo on it. What's this CD?
Well, when Record Store Day started, Zia decided that it would be a really cool time to sort of revive a series that Zia had done in the past, in the 90s, all sorts of Phoenix music compilations. And by the time, 2008 rolled around, we had stores in Tucson and Vegas as well. So what we did was we started a series called You Heard Us Back When, and we started accepting submissions from Phoenix bands, from Tucson bands, from Vegas bands. We put them all together on a compilation. The first year it was, one disc, and by now, on our eighth volume, it's two discs and 40 songs featuring music from all over the Southwest.
Just a little foolishness will make your light dim. Head opposite the fool, be nothing like him. Because the wise go right, but he decide to go left. So even as he walk along, you see how stupid he get. Too many people walk the path of the previous fools. So the good road is traveled by the precious few. Now, the wicked rule, and the righteous live low. See these fools drive by, the wise taking it slow.
So that was LB and the Brothers Cosmos, a Southwest-based band. Jason Woodbury of Zia Records, thanks so much.
Hey, it was a real pleasure. Thank you.
A dull blade to make the log split. There's no profit for the charmer if the charmer gets bit.
KJZZ is supported by Eastmark, building new homes and businesses, schools and parks, all found in one East Valley community. Eastmark, the heart and hub of the East Valley. More at eastmark.com.
One of the biggest and most obvious attractions in the North Valley is one you probably wouldn't expect to find in the middle of the Arizona desert. KJZZ's Nadine Arroyo Rodriguez takes a trip up to the valley's version of Old Faithful.
The fountain is a tourist attraction for the town of Fountain Hills. It's been running thousands of gallons daily since the town was founded in 1970. Did you know the fountain is said to be the third largest man-made fountain in the world?
We used to be the tallest, recognized by Guinness as the world's tallest fountain.
Mark Mayer is the town's director of community services.
There are now, that we know of, two more that have been built. One is in St. Louis, and that operates on an annual basis but does not operate over the winter. And then a second one that was recently built in Dubai, and they operate on salt water. So we no longer call ourselves the world's tallest fountain. We call ourselves the world's tallest continuously running freshwater fountain.
The fountain was part of a community master project. C.V. Wood Jr., the same man who developed Disneyland, came up with the idea of putting a fountain in the middle of the town. It sits in the center of a man-made lake on a 64-acre park. The concrete base sculpture was built in Zurich, Switzerland. It's about 7 feet in length and weighs about a ton, literally. The fountain is driven by three pumps that propel thousands of gallons of water that climb to different levels. It normally pushes water to 330 feet, higher than the Statue of Liberty. And on a special occasion, it runs at its maximum height of 560 feet.
We maintain the pumps and everything to drive the fountain. It takes 3 600-horse motors, and we spend annually between $140,000 and $150,000 a year to run the fountain. That doesn't include the maintenance that we also do on the fountain. That's just the electrical charges.
The fountain runs at the top of the hour for 15 minutes between 9 a.m. and 9 p.m. It sprays more than 100,000 gallons of water each time. Mayor says the lake and fountain water are reclaimed wastewater.
It's called Class A. It's the highest and cleanest level that you can get. We use it not only to service the fountain, but we also irrigate almost 35 acres of turf with it as well.
The fountain also uses one other resource to maintain it. Koi fish linger at the bottom. They were put here to help control midge flies, those harmless humming swarms often found around water. It's the show. I'm Nadine Arroyo Rodriguez.
We want to know what you know. Send us a note to the show at kjzz.org. As always, lots of great stuff to do around the valley this weekend. Earth Day coming up next week, but there are a few things going on this weekend around the valley, including Zero Waste Day at the Tempe Fire Training Facility. You can drop off electronics, tires, and other items there. The Phoenix Improv Festival is this weekend at the Herberger Theater Center. You can also catch violinist Ray Chen performing Mozart's Violin Concert No. 4 in performances with the Phoenix Symphony. And Wingstock 2014, it's considered where music and chicken meet. Just let you stew on that for a minute. The show is produced this week by Sarah Ventry, Nick Blumberg, and Nadine Arroyo Rodriguez, with help from Tiara Vian, Anika Klein, Bruce Drummond, Alexandra Olgan, and Kendra Sabo. Tracy Greer is our digital media editor. Our managing editor is Al Macias. News director Peter O'Dowd, and our executive producer is John Hoban. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks so much for listening. This is listener-supported KJZZ-FM Phoenix and HD at 3 o'clock.